that we'll get screwed. Remember the happy things on afterward. Heart is a sanctuary, silence and solitude. Rather in a brothel or chocolate chip factory or a chemistry set. My life is broken and I can't afford to repair it. She's bad for me and cruel to me and disrespectful of boundaries. But flies when you're having time. Schism, the sacrificed our love like a pig to some guy. But what of me? The lingering pain kept the memories vivid. A tree lies passion bubbling, protoplasm for synapses. My life is broken and I can't afford to repair it. She's bad for me and cruel to me and disrespectful of boundaries. But flies when you're having time. Thank God boredom's not a crime. Sustaining a mood of wistful reticence, I will get screwed. Remember the happy things on afterward. Sanctuary, silence and solitude. Rather in a brothel or chocolate chip factory or a chemistry set. I lost a world where I belong. Where do I belong? She's bad for me and cruel to me and disrespectful of boundaries. But flies when you're having time. Said we'll get screwed. Remember the happy things on afterward.
It's Inkstead CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. That was The Action Suits, and this is the show about comics, and we're joined this week by Mr. Peter Bagg, creator of many wonderful things. You there, Peter?
Yeah, I'm here. How you doing?
Excellent, excellent. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having.
Hello, it's Colin.
Hey, Colin, I haven't spoken to you or seen you in ages.
Oh, don't get down to Seattle as much as I used to.
Oh.
I think
well,
he's
good
on
for you. There's nothing to see.
I think Colin's on some terrorist watch list or something.
Hey, they haven't surprised me.
They haven't stopped me at the border yet.
That's because you haven't tried yet.
Watch out for Colin Upton. So we got you on because we're both huge fans, Colin and I. And, I mean, your work is breakthrough, time-lasting, excellent. And this month, I guess we have two new comics by you. We got The Apocalypse Nerd number 3.
Right.
And The Hate Annual, I guess it's number 6.
Correct.
Correct. Featuring a, What's Happened to Stinky's Body.
Oh.
That's right. It's kind of that, it features a story about a corpse.
And I loved it.
Oh, well, thanks.
It was, we're both, Colin, are very happy to have some new stuff to read. So, first, I guess we'll start talking about the newest comics coming out, and then I want to kind of ask some questions about music, because we just played The Action Suits, which is
right.
Your band, well, a band that you are in with a couple other folks.
Right.
Eric Reynolds, I forget the name of the other person.
Bass player's name is Andy Schmidt.
Andy Schmidt. And then Al Columbia used to be involved in it 2 years
ago. Right. The cartoonist Al Columbia, who, not a household name by any stretch, but for people who do know his work, he's got a rather passionate cult following, it seems. Very, very extremely talented visual artist. But a rather bizarre, elusive character. And him, 10 years ago, they were all living in the same house. Colin might remember this house. There was this rundown greenhouse and an awful lot of people that had some kind of association with Fantagraphics, my publisher. It was like a very cheap place to live in this big greenhouse. And so Eric Reynolds, who's a cartoonist and he collaborates with me, and kind of he became the main guy in The Action Suits, Him and Al Columbia were both living there, and so was this fellow named Andy, and they formed the Action Suits. And the day that I joined and I went to practice with them, we practiced for about an hour, 45 minutes, and then Al Columbia said he wanted to take a break, and he went upstairs to his bedroom, where he stayed for the next 2 weeks. So I guess my drumming didn't please him too much. I don't know what happened, but then the next time I came to practice, I was like, where's Al? And they said he's in his room. They said he hasn't left his room since last practice.
I think Al Columbia.
I was like, what are we going to do? And they were like, screw him. Let's just, you know, let him be that way. We'll just continue without him. That was my experience of being in the same band as Al Columbia.
I think he has the legend of the missing guy after Big Numbers. And I think there's about, five comics out there by him?
Would you think your listeners would be familiar with the Alan Moore comic?
Most of our stuff is primarily underground and alternative, so I think a fair amount will know.
Yeah, I don't know the details of that story, but that predates
that's a whole
story I was telling, but that apparently Al Columbia was hired to finish the art we collaborated on, this graphic novel, very ambitious book that Alan Moore wrote called Big Numbers. Mm. And apparently he was late with it, and the publisher was screaming at him to get the artwork in, so he was driving in. This is before email, where you could just attach the artwork, and so he had the actual artwork, the actual boards in his car. And apparently he was driving in his car on his way to the publisher, just had some weird, crazy fit, rolled down the window, took all the artwork, and just flung it out the window on the highway.
Wow, I've never heard that part.
Yeah.
He's like the madman legend of comics.
Yeah, so it seems. No, he's not the madman legend, he's the madman.
There's no legend to it, it's all true.
No, it's just a fact.
Well, enough, Al. We're here to talk to you. So Apocalypse Nerd number 3, pulling out my stack of comics here, they've made friends with the compound. And I gotta say, my favorite part about Apocalypse Nerd is the founder's stories.
Oh.
The backup stuff.
Ryan, that's what everybody tells me.
The founding father's funny. It's like, the Apocalypse Nerd's great, but the founding funny, it's just so original and just, in this age of, patriotism and everything sacred.
Right.
You just take something that's really sacred and just give it a new face.
Well, it's just my own take on the founding fathers. I love to read about that stuff. That's like my favorite period in history to read about. I'm just fascinated by all those characters. And at the same time, I've noticed, I was a little bit self-conscious not being an historian. I was self-conscious about writing about them, like, who the heck am I? But then when I would read a lot of these biographies, I began to become aware of the fact that everybody was giving their own very personal stamps on these characters. You could read two books about Alexander Hamilton, and you come away thinking you just read two books about two completely different people. Or, for example, some people become so attached to the subject matter that, for example, I, at the same time I read a book about Alexander Hamilton, and the author was his champion. He says, this is a great man. I also, at the same time, read a book about John Adams, and the two of them didn't get along, Adams and Alexander Hamilton. So in both books, the authors of both books made the other guy out to be a buffoon, a backstabber, a liar, a fraud. Like, everything that John Adams thought about Alexander Hamilton, his biographer thought the same thing. He didn't even question it. He's just like, Alexander Hamilton, the biggest scallywag in American history. And that's the other thing, too. I went to, I was writing something for Reason Magazine, and they sent me to this event where I was writing something about the Republican Party, so I went to this fundraiser out in the suburbs, out in a city called Bellevue. And I was curious to go, not just to see, what this fundraiser would be like, but also because the guest speaker is somebody who just wrote a book about the founding fathers. So I thought, well, at the very least, I'll be interested in what this guy had to say. And what this guy was trying to do is he was taking not just some of them, he was taking all the founding fathers, every single one of them, and cramming them into this very narrow hole as a way of saying that exactly what today's 2002 or whatever year it was, 2004, exactly what the Republican Party's platform is right now, that's exactly what every single founding father thought. He was painting this picture where if all of them, Washington, Franklin, every single one of them, if they were all alive today, they would be 100% behind George Bush. And it was amazing. Like he started saying, this guy started saying, he goes, some people, they try to debate what the founders' religious beliefs were. He goes, every single one of them was born and raised a Christian, and never for a second did they doubt their faith. Throughout their entire lives, every single one of them was a devout, unwavering Christian. And when he said that, my jaw dropped. I was like, don't... You know, maybe you can question books written about the founding fathers, but you can read their own writing. You can read their own autobiographies where they question their faith constantly. They were intellectuals. They were smart guys. And like all smart people, they question things. And that was just such an amazing lie. So then I was like, screw it. I'm just going to, like, whatever I think of all these guys, I'm just going to write about it and make it exactly the way I see them.
Well, there's something almost sacred, it seems, with the way that the founding fathers are regarded in American history.
Yeah, for people who don't read about them, you know, and just want to think that there's something, that they were superhuman and not these. You know, and you know, I love them for their flaws. What's funny when I read about them, the reason I want to do a comic about them is they are cartoon characters. They had very complex and amusing personality, and the conflicts they had with each other, they were constantly, almost on a weekly basis, going from loving each other to hating each other's guts, you know? The one thing that, to tell you the truth, one thing that I really admire about them is, as passionate as they were, none of them, unlike other people during revolutionary times, none of them were bloodthirsty. They never literally went after each other, except for duels. But back in those days, every society had duels. That was just a fact of life until modern times. So there was the famous incident of Hamilton and Burr, which some people say was political, but it was actually very, very personal. You know, they were both ambitious, but it was all over personal stuff that they wound up shooting at each other. But other than that, it really is amazing that they never, compared to, like, say, the French Revolution, which happened at the same time, that they never wound up killing each other. There was, even in Boston, during the Boston Tea Party, all that stuff, all of their political theater, like, there was always the threat of violence, and sometimes it would get somewhat violent, but they rarely murdered each other. Their terrorism, and they were, in a sense, terrorists, but it was all very theatrical.
Well,
they didn't kill people, you know?
I think there might be some United Empire loyalists who would have disagreed.
Well, like with all the tarring and feathering, that was truly horrible. But that type of stuff was happening on both sides. But it was at least as far as, like, except for, like, when they actually started fighting the war, you know? And then it was a war. And then, of course, yeah, people were shooting at each other. And in America, we tend to forget how much of it was a civil war, how many people were Tories and loyal to the crown, you know. But people were awful to each other on both sides, depending on who was in power at any given moment. This isn't about comics.
Yes, it is.
It's the fun part of our show. We you know, it's basically like an hour of conversation, I think. So.
Right.
I'm a history nerd. So.
Yeah. Colin is our in-house nerd, and I'm taking history in school right now.
He could correct everything that.
Halfway through, Colin will make some reference to an obscure battle and somewhere, and we'll all just sit there kind of dumbfounded.
Right, and everybody changes the channel.
So, why the is it kind of a juxtaposition between the apocalypse nerd storyline and the founding father storyline? Like, you kind of have, like, the modern...
It's the beginning of the country and the end of the country. Yeah. You forgive my pessimism.
It's the follow-through of the American spirit.
Yeah, it's just, in part, it's an allegory for how Americans just all completely lost their mind in the wake of 9/11. and we've just been running around like a bunch of Chicken Littles ever since. But at the same time, too, it was very much inspired by the fact that at the very same time, the Bush administration was doing everything they could to make a case for going to war against Iraq and trying to make Iraq to be a threat to America, even though they weren't at all. At that very same time, I was hearing on the news, they quoted on NPR an ambassador from North Korea who said, "We have both the capability and the willingness to strike Seattle with a nuclear bomb." and when I heard that statement, it elicited no reaction from the White House. Mm-hmm. This was a direct threat to nuke us, and they completely ignored it. Because at that time they were trying to create a case for going to war against Iraq. So I was flabbergasted. Like, here they are, like, showing photographs of trucks and saying there's bombs in them. You know, take our word for it. When here another country just directly threatened us, even if they might have been completely full of it, and hopefully they were.
Well, especially after the recent misfires.
Yeah, it's like, since I live in Seattle, that of course made me think, what would it be like and what would I be like if suddenly Seattle was nuked, but I wound up alive, like if I just happened to be in the woods at the time. So that was where that story came from.
So you are the apocalypse nerd?
Yeah. I imagine that I'd be like that one main character. You know, I drew him like as your quintessential nerd, you know, rail thin with horn-rimmed glasses, who works for a computer company, which I don't. But other than that, yeah, I'd imagine I'd be like him, just utterly pathetic and crying all the time, you know, and staying alive by being somebody's bitch who seems to know the woods a little bit better than I do.
It's like an episode of Oz, almost.
Yeah. And, you know, the story's gonna, you know, I'm only halfway done with the story. It's a 6-part miniseries, and so it's gonna take some more unexpected twists and turns.
Well, I'm looking forward to the continuation.
Yeah, it's taking me a lot longer to draw the thing, too, than, you know, I'm getting slowing down in my old age.
I think it was originally solicited as, was it bi-monthly?
Yeah, that was a big, huge, fat lie on my part. What I was hoping to do was get a whole bunch of issues done before the first issue came out. But for countless reasons, that was impossible. Actually, for one very good reason, I signed on to do Apocalypse Nerd. I also agreed to do a weekly strip for the Weekly World News.
The Batboy.
Batboy, yeah, which I did for 2 years, but I'm not doing it anymore. So hopefully Apocalypse Nerd will start coming out more often.
I have a couple of questions with Apocalypse Nerd about the production of it. Now, why the choice with Dark Horse, when normally, I mean, you're like, you know, a stable in-house Fantagraphics creator?
Well, my comics don't sell as good as they used to. You know, like Hate Annual only like sells half of what the old Hate sold back in the 90s. And the way Fantagraphics operates is you get paid a percentage of the sales. So I couldn't help but think that if I started a brand new title with them, that it would sell the equivalent of Hate Annual, and that's just not enough to live on anymore. So with the Dark Horse, I simply asked them. Somebody told me that they had this arrangement, so I asked them too if they would give me a flat page rate. So even if it completely tanked, I still would make this bottom rung page rate from them, and they agreed. So, and it's not great. It's not a king's ransom what they're paying me, but I don't think at all about how it's selling. You know, I just put that out of my mind and just concentrate on doing the comic, knowing that I'll get this set fee for each issue.
Is it almost art for art? You're actually able to more focus on telling the story than...
That's just it. The thing is, like, if it did tank, if sales just wound up really low and the pay went down the toilet with it, I just couldn't afford to keep it going. I would have just had to have dropped it. So I just simply told them, you know, you know, and they completely agreed. I said, this isn't a huge commitment on your part. It's just a miniseries. So, you know, we'll just agree to 6 issues and see what happens. And they said, fine. You know, they seemed like they were eager to work with me, which was nice. So, whether whether I do anything more with them when this is done remains to be seen. You know, they might, if assuming it is selling horribly, they might tell me to stay far, far away from them. But we'll find out when we get there.
And Colin has a question.
Oh, I was just wondering, you're inking Apocalypse Nerd?
Yeah.
Yeah, because at one point, wasn't Jim Blanchard inking
with
Hate?
With Hate, when I switched it to color, I decided to work with an inker for two reasons. One is it was being inked on Photoshop. I mean, it was being colored, I'm sorry. It was being colored on Photoshop. And I knew from experience that, you know, everything had to be very trapped to make the coloring easier. You know, every single shape had to be enclosed with the black line. Mm-hmm. And my artwork my inking tended to be a bit jagged, especially back then. So I was just afraid that I would drive the colorist crazy. And plus, I wanted the stories to be more dense. Like, I don't know if you remember, but the early black and white Hates, there tended to be like 3 tiers per page. And then with the color ones, I made them 4 tiers per page because I wanted there to be more story. The stories just became a lot denser, which was more labor-intensive. So again, just to save time and to keep the colorist from going crazy, I decided to have Jim Blanchard ink the work, just because his inking was just so much tighter than mine, and I thought the coloring would work better on it. And it didn't come out any faster, though, than when I was doing it in black and white.
I just put
even more work into each issue than I was previously.
Well, it's interesting looking at Jim Blanchard's other work. He doesn't, like, technically very tight, but the style is completely different from
He draws is nothing like the way I draw.
It's more of a realist grotesque.
Yeah, and in realist / psychedelic crazy person. Not the pillar of sanity, but the nature of his work is very different.
I was always afraid he was going to hit me or something.
Yeah, he exudes surly demeanor. Which, you know, yeah, I was about to say, but in real life, he's a pussycat. That seemed like the obvious next thing to say, but that's not true. He used to be quite the brawler back in his young days. I mean, but he's all married now, and, hopefully, he lives up in Bellingham, so I hardly ever see him anymore. But hopefully he's calmed down. But yeah, he used to be a bit of a roughneck, actually.
Don't find a lot of those in comics.
No, you don't.
It's kind of a breath of fresh air.
He was very atypical for an underground or alternative cartoonist.
And that's just one thing I've heard from a lot of people is that Jim Blanchard in person is actually, like, from people I know who've met him have said he's actually been the nicest guy.
Well, yeah, no, that's true. He is a nice gentleman. Guy, but
kind of intense.
But then
but
he
a legend.
Used to literally like to tear things up on the weekends. You know, but yeah, during the weekday he was, you know, perfectly. I mean, I couldn't have worked with him otherwise.
I guess we'll get into Hate Annual 6. I think we pretty much covered a bunch of the nerd stuff. Oh, yeah, one last question. Black and white. Everything else recently has been in color of your newer stuff. Why
right.
the choice for the black and white with the shades?
Well, one thing was because I wanted to, even though I was pretty rusty, I wanted to go back to doing a lot of cross-hatchy artwork like I used to do in the early Hates, at least with the... with the Founding Father strips, again, just to give it kind of an old-fashioned-y look. And so that was one of the reasons I did it in black and white. And then I figured, well, if that's in black and white, I'll have Apocalypse Nerd in black and white. Although I quote-unquote color it with gray tones. Mm-hmm. I'm adding gray tones to it, which I had started doing with Bat Boy. Weekly World News, in the Weekly World News, everything is black and white, so the Bat Boy strip had to be in black and white. But on Photoshop, I was filling it in with various gray tones, and I liked the effect. So then when I started Apocalypse Nerd, I wanted to do the same thing.
How much has... I know a lot of cartoonists really utilize Photoshop for a lot of different reasons. How much has that become a factor for you?
It's a big one, and in one way that it's been detrimental, and this is totally my fault, is now when I finish a page, it really isn't finished. It'll have some screw-ups and mess-ups on it, but I hate messing with whiteout, so I'm fixing my mistakes in the computer. You know, I'll scan it, like I'll have some words misspelled, some things should be shifted around, but rather than just blobbing on the whiteout and waiting for it to dry and struggling while I try to ink on top of the whiteout, now I just scan it and I fix all those mistakes in Photoshop. But I don't know. I feel like I'm cheating that way. Also, I feel bad for anybody who will later on buy my original art, thinking they're getting what they saw in the comic, and then they get this thing with all these whopping spelling mistakes and ink blotches all over the place.
So no more Bat Boy. That's it for Bat Boy. That's in this the Hate Annual number 6.
Yeah, and then there's a whole bunch of Bat Boys that still haven't been reprinted. There's one little less story thread, and that'll be in the next Hate Annual.
So that'll be out in 2007.
Seven, yeah.
In the fall, I guess.
Whenever I manage to get it together. Hasn't exactly been annual.
Yeah, I'm very happy to get each one though, and it's nice to see you revisiting on Stinky. It felt when you killed him off. I don't know if that sounds right saying you killed him off, but he was a pretty popular character, and it's neat just to bring back Stinky almost being Stinky again as a corpse, just being this like disgusting corpse hanging in the yard, and still causing trouble among people.
Everybody tells me his name is Stinky, and why'd you go and kill him? He wasn't, with the color hates, he wasn't much of a factor at all. He just made a couple of cameo appearances. And he also is the type of character, too, that if I did keep using him a lot, I think he just would have driven everybody crazy.
He would have become a character of a caricature.
Well, yeah, because, hate is like Gasoline Alley, where everybody is aging and changing, and the older people naturally mellow. And he would he would have had to have mellowed if he was going to stay alive, but then he wouldn't be Stinky anymore. Then why have him? Or else he could just keep tragically going on being the way he is. And that is how I was portraying. I was portraying him as a guy that wasn't growing up and was just in this mad spiral.
So now he's just sad.
And just didn't, which if you show him a lot, if he was like in every issue and he just kept running around like a chicken with his head cut off, which is him in a nutshell, it would have become really pathetic and really annoying. And also people like that who can't grow up and can't calm down and keep running in circles, they self-destruct. So I just had them self-destruct, basically.
And you know, it worked in the storyline. It was, you know, it wasn't a shock as, like, you know, it's something you could see happening to him instead of
just... That's funny. I thought that I foreshadowed his death quite a bit. I mean, not to the point of giving it away, but I didn't think it would come as a total surprise. But it's interesting that you saw that, because most people didn't. A lot of people just did not see it coming.
Well, it's in real life, like, you, if you know people like that, you know, and in Canada, we got lots of, you know, the FUBAR-esque characters who live their lives and go, 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 and sleazy, 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 and they don't age gracefully.
Right.
And I think, you know, maybe that's what Stinky was like. He's not Stinky anymore.
Right.
Maybe he's extra Stinky, I guess, is the problem.
Extra Stinky. No, he was getting, I mean, he was becoming a criminal, basically, and a more dangerous criminal. You know, dangerous for him, anyway. If you recall, he was driving around with an Uzi and pounds of pot that didn't belong to him in a U.S. mail truck. Although, it's funny, all of that is based on real life. I went to, I went back east to where I grew up in upstate New York to my father's funeral, and I bumped into a bunch of my old friends, and I just couldn't believe how quasi-legal some of their existences were. Just all these little side, quote-unquote, businesses that they had. All these scams. It's just such a criminal mentality, such a borderline criminal society.
Always trying to get the next.
Compared to Seattle, anyway. In Seattle in the Northwest, it's so cupcake and law and order, law abiding compared to back east.
Is that
so,
why?
And all that stuff that Sticky was doing, you know, using a mail truck and when he wasn't even a mailman to deliver pot, that was what old friends of mine were doing back in New York.
Is that why you moved Buddy Bradley out of Seattle? It was too nice?
Yeah, well, I moved out of Seattle for various reasons. And then when I decided to do Hate, and I decided to, since Buddy already was proven to was evolving into like a perfect stand-in for me in Neat Stuff when he was part of the Bradley family. I figured, well, I'll age him again. And just all the stuff that happened to me when I moved out of my parents' house, like when I was 20, or my early 20s, I'll have happened to him. But then, you know, I hadn't been living on the East Coast for over 5 years at that time. And I like giving with him anyway, with the Bradley family and with him, I like giving them a strong sense of place. I didn't want it to be Anytown USA. But I just thought, how can I keep having him living in the suburbs of New York when I don't live there anymore? So I just figured, what the hell, you know, Seattle's full of people who moved there for next to no reason. You know, I'll just have them do the same. And that way, when I need backgrounds, when I draw backgrounds, need, you know, just draw the places that are near my house. You know, so it was for convenience sake more than anything else.
So, in many aspects, Hate is a little bit autobiographical.
Yes, yes. I used to deny that just because I didn't want to take the blame for everything that somebody said and did. But one time there was some magazine, they sent me a questionnaire. And they said, here's 12 questions we want you to answer. But they said, don't answer it as yourself. We want it. You to answer it as Buddy Bradley. We're going to call it an interview with Buddy Bradley. So pretend you're Buddy and answer all the questions as your character. So I did, and after I answered all the questions, I looked at it and I realized I would have answered all these questions exactly the same. So then I was like, well, I can't deny it anymore. I am Buddy Bradley.
Wow.
And just with a smaller nose.
That's it.
How long have you been drawing Buddy and the Bradleys? I mean,
the first time I ever drew Buddy Bradley was like in 1980. I was just sitting around with me and my wife and an old roommate of ours. We used to just every now and then when we were bored, we'd just grab pieces of paper and just draw. We would all draw like ridiculous, filthy scatological comics to amuse each other. And with the Bradleys, all it was I drew my family, but presented them like they were the Brady Bunch. Like, hey, here's America's favorite family. But, you know, I drew them all dysfunctional and screwy, you know, just this little one-page thing, you know, with stuff like, Grandma's dead and nobody noticed, stuff like that. And I found it amusing, and then it seemed natural to just keep that family going. You know, all the time being very well aware of the fact that I was satirizing my own family.
Yeah, I've got comical funnies 1-3. Is that
did you just get them recently or?
No, I bought them from you.
Oh, okay.
After you moved to Seattle, I came to visit.
Right.
And I bought them from you, and it's just like,
yeah, and they have very badly drawn Bradley family comics in there.
Well, it's very, very jealous of Colin's collection of stuff.
So, I see, like, comical funnies. You got John Holmstrom and the Ramones on the cover, and this is, like, 1980. So, what was punk rock big in New York at the time?
Yeah, there and a few other places. And, again, it was only, you know, this is a funny thing. Holmstrom, well, he couldn't run a profitable business anyway, but John Holmstrom, he's probably known best by far. He is best known as the cartoonist who drew some of the early Ramones covers, like the cover to Road to Ruin. But he also, back in the day, started a magazine called Punk. It was like the first punk fanzine, and it was a fantastic magazine because it very successfully combined rock with comics, which, you know, was like two of my first loves too. And it especially lent itself well to the whole punk style, since it's so cartoony, so simple and cartoony. So I love the magazine, and those are the first cartoonists I befriended were Holmstrom and a bunch of the couple other guys that worked on Punk magazine. You know, the functioning staff at Punk was almost all cartoonists, and he would have kept it going. He was having a hard time keeping it profitable, largely because they weren't very good businessmen, but also Punk just didn't seem to be catching on, surprisingly. Like, the Ramones, they all thought that punk would take over. But by 1979, 1980, you know, it seemed like more new wavy-sounding acts were getting more popular. And even Blondie, who was one of their favorite early punk bands, they started getting number one hits, but you know, it was like disco song. So they just thought that's it. Most people just hated punk rock with a passion. When you'd go to a club in New York City, there'd be all these Goombas from the Queens who would come in, and they would just hang out outside punk clubs looking for a fight. You know, they'd be like, you call that music? They don't even know how to do guitar solos. And if you argued with them, you'd, you know, get a fist in your face. So it just didn't, you know, if he stuck with it, if he was doing punk now, it would probably be selling a million copies. But it just seemed like that's it. Punk is dead.
Were you a punk?
Not in that cartoony sense. And you know what? I even like my favorite punk bands for the most part were the more new wavy ones.
Mm-hmm.
I like the Talking Heads and the B-52s and Devo. I like the Ramones too, but a lot of like the really punky punk bands, you know, like the Heartbreakers and the Damned. I didn't really like any of them. I just thought that, you know, their music, it was too crappy. You know, it just sounded like slop. And that's the other thing too is I didn't like, again, even though I like the Ramones, a lot of people, that whole look and attitude was like a religion. And you'd go to a club where literally every single person in the club had that same black leather jacket with a white t-shirt underneath it. And they weren't fun. You know, even the Ramones were funny and they had a sense of humor, even though they had that serious veneer, you know, they had that serious pouty look. But, you know, that was a joke. But a lot of people, for some reason, took it seriously. So when the most unfun clubs were these punk clubs where everybody was really serious and scowly and obnoxious. The more new wavy clubs were a lot more fun. You know, the girls were a lot cuter with their spandex mini skirts and
probably less
and everybody
STDs.
Danced more. They played a wider, like they would play a disco song. They'd play the good disco songs. And they'd also play like really great. So they would like play the Archies and just anything that was great to dance to, but that, you know, the general public didn't consider to be good music, but that I did. So that was more like my people, you know. So I wore a skinny tie and all that crap.
Well, one thing I noticed is your love of pop, which I appreciate and respect, is a lot of people kind of, you know, pretend to be sometimes, you know, into the thing, especially with yourself being kind of, your comics being iconicized, I guess, I don't know if that's the right term, with the grunge movement and Collins
right.
Holding up his grunge pencils.
my Peter bag, grunge pencils.
People always just assume I like, not even so much grunge, but like garage rock. Because I often illustrate covers for very garagey sounding, really hard, rough edge sounding bands. And I can understand why, because my artwork is well suited to that. Like Britney Spears is never going to ask me to do a record cover for her. But all these garagey bands do. And so people quite naturally assume that's my style of music. And while I'm not against that music, well, at the same time, I'll be perfectly happy if I never hear another garage band ever again. And it's also samey, you know?
Yeah.
It's just really samey. And, you know, it's okay. I'm not against it. And I love, you know, I love the whole DIY aspect of it. I love the fact that like a bunch of people learn to play guitar when they're 30, you know, and put out some records, you know, and come up with a ridiculous name. But yeah, for the most part, I like what I like is like music with a beat. You know, it doesn't even have to be rock and roll. You know, it could be R&B, but with lots of hooks. I like it upbeat and very hooky, and I like lots of harmonies. So, you know, the Beatles and the Beach Boys, they're my two favorite bands of all time. And they were, you know, since the Beatles and the Beach Boys music evolved and everybody recognized that, like, Lennon and McCartney and Brian Wilson, they were musical geniuses, they forget that they started out making bubblegum music. It was teeny popper music.
Mm-hmm.
And very few people took it seriously or considered it great music, you know, that these guys are musical geniuses. But it is great music. You know, John Lennon is the greatest bubblegum songwriter of all time. You know, he completely moved away from that by 1965, but in 63 and 64 he was writing, he was more prolific than Paul, and his stuff, he was the one writing I Want to Hold Your Hand and all that stuff like that. And it's just all hooks and he and she and Let's Fall in Love. You know, it was all teenage, it was the human mating call. And in the same with Buddy Holly, that was all pure bubblegum. So that's my favorite music, is that kind of stuff.
Are you still enjoying your daughter's music collection after
the
Spice Capades?
Well, she's completely moved on. Now she's, like, embarrassed of what I listen to.
Dad, turn off the Bewitched.
She's into, you know, Green Day. I think even Green Day is going to be too bubblegummy for her.
I'm going to pass on Green Day.
Was there any danger, do you think, of being your work being identified with grunge?
Well, it's a problem in that there's... I mean, there are people who just think of me as that. They go, oh, yeah, he's the grunge cartoonist. But they obviously aren't people who read my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they wouldn't think of me solely that way if they actually read the comics. So for anybody who thinks of me as the grunge cartoonist, my choice is either that's how they'll think of me or they won't know me at all. It's like, I use this quote a lot, but one time I was listening to the actor Peter Falk being interviewed. It was on Terry Gross. I don't know if you get that show. She's an NPR interviewer. And she said, she was telling him, you're a well-respected actor. You've done played such a wide variety of roles, and yet you're almost solely known by the general public as the guy who played Columbo, the detective on that old TV show. And she says, does it bother you to be known primarily as Columbo? And the guy went, Peter Falk just went, you know, it beats cancer. So that's my answer. I stole his answer. It most definitely beats cancer, being known as the grunge guy. But just barely.
Beating cancer. Or not being cancer. The music director at the station, he's a huge fan of yours, and he had a question about a painting that his girlfriend bought off Wayno. That was by you, and he wanted to know if you remember doing it, about a guy named Alfred, a green guy sitting on a beach listening to Van Halen and Rush.
Yeah, I don't enjoy painting, so I've done very few, even in art school. I took painting classes, but I only painted just, you know, in response to an assignment. I just don't like the messiness of it. But I did this crazy thing once with these two other cartoonists. One is a cartoonist I'm sure you've heard of named Kaz.
Oh, yes.
Who does the comic strip Underworld. Him, and there was another cartoonist named Ken Wiener, who now changed his name. He now goes by the name Ken Avador. And he was one of the old punk cartoonists. The three of us got this crazy notion to just be, like, crazy borderline graffiti artist, but rather than graffiti, what we did was we would just draw ugly faces, kind of like in the 60s, the Topps Bubblegum Company, they put out these things called ugly stickers, and it would be like Basil Wolverton and Wally Wood. They just drew these ugly, ugly, ugly monster faces, but then they'd put a name on it, like it would say Betty or Peter. So like if I get one and it says Fred and I know somebody named Fred, I go, ha-ha, this is you. So that's what we did, is we just drew our own ugly faces. And we didn't make stickers out of it, but we just made small little Xeroxes of all our ugly faces and gave them names. And then we would just glue them around town, just like in New York City. To be honest, we were somewhat inspired by Keith Haring, who was becoming famous. He first became famous by just graffitiing his little drawings everywhere, but we didn't want to graffiti, so we just made flyers and glued them. And then we thought the next step is that, you know, we thought we were going to be, you know, art heroes, that we were going to be the next Keith Haring. Yeah, we were quite deluded. So we actually found a gallery owner who said he would show our ugly drawings, the originals, but he also wanted paintings. And none of us painted, but then we all went home and we bought illustration boards and canvases and acrylic paint. And again, none of us knew how to paint, so we just all painted the ugliest paintings you'd ever seen. And the reason that one that your friend's girlfriend said she bought,
yeah,
Alfred, the reason that looks decent at all, the reason the colors at least work on some level, is because my wife, Joanne, finished it for me. It just came out so bad, it was driving her crazy, and she knows how to paint.
That's right,
to this day,
she
helped me with the Photoshop coloring.
So
she does a lot of my coloring for me. She's very good at getting a color. I have the hardest time getting like a working color scheme going, whereas it's easy for her. And usually I just finish it. I'll just do all the finished details in the coloring. So with these paintings, the opposite. I started it they were like ugly in a bad way, and she finished them up for me and made them presentable.
Well, what are the covers of Apocalypse Nerd? What are they done in?
Watercolor, and they're watercolor, and then gouache, just because gouache is more opaque. And even though I've been trying really hard to resist finishing it off, finishing off with like color pencils or pens or anything like that, I kind of have to do that because they've been coming out too flat. The originals mm-hmm. don't look nearly as flat as they wind up in print, but in print they've been coming out really flat. So now once the watercolor is done, I'm still going over that now with both color pencils and even like markers and ink and stuff like that, just to make the highlights and the darks a lot sharper, just so they'll look better in print.
I have a question about a lot of the hates near the end, or I guess throughout the whole thing, is one feature was what you're enjoying for new comics. And we don't see that anymore. So what are you enjoying for new comics?
This is going to sound awful, and I know it's really typical old man talk. I'm very prejudiced towards cartoonists who are like from my own generation. That's still my favorite stuff is the Hernandez brothers and Joe Sacco and Dan Clowes and the Drawn and Quarterly guys hardly draw anything anymore. But
Well, Chester Brown's got a new book coming out sometime about.
Okay, yeah, I like everything that he does. And the Fantagraphics guys are still my favorite. Of the newer guys, when I say younger, when I say the younger cartoonist, I'm talking about anybody under 40. I really love this guy named Johnny Ryan, who does Angry Eagle Comics. I'm sure you know his stuff.
Oh, you did. Hitler.
It's hilarious. It's just funny in a really oddly direct way. He just cracks me up. And I love his drawings, too. And
Hitler was awesome. I loved Hitler, the thing you guys did together.
Oh, thanks. I thought you said Hitler.
No, yeah. I don't love Hitler.
Make this very clear.
Yeah, we do not love Hitler. We love Hitler.
There you go. Who doesn't love Hitler?
That was awesome.
I still, every now and then, people still send me comics. There's an awful lot of... In fact, just the other day, I got two comics in the mail. I'm looking at them right now. And they were good. It's by these young guys I never heard of. One guy's name... Oh, one I just put away. His name is Max Kohlfelter. I think that's his name. Kohlfelter?
No.
He has a website. I'm getting his name wrong, I'm sure. I wish... Now I can't find his comic. The really oddball stuff. But it's funny, like, every single character is a drunk. Everybody's drunk in all comics. and now I'm looking at one. I'm looking at a comic. This guy's very Dan Clowes inspired, and the comic is called Sucker Punch. It's this little self-published thing, and I can't find his name anywhere in the comic. He didn't sign his own goddamn comic book. What's wrong with these people?
These kids these days.
They figure just like, is there a web address?
Here's something. It says, thanks for reading Sucker Punch. Number two.
They don't need addresses.
Oh, and then there's a website.
Yeah, that's it. There's a web.
It's always a website.
It's always a website.
Shortpants Press.
No, .com.
No, doesn't ring a bell. God, put your name in here, you moron. Oh, there it is.
Oh.
Mark Jason Robert Robards.
Never.
Jason Robards. He's back from the dead and drawing mini comics.
All right, zombie comics. Something that you and Johnny Ryan both do, and I'm wondering where the source of it is the end of a gag, someone falling backwards with their lace going up.
Right.
Where did that come from?
Oh, that's just
is that an old mad thing?
That's ancient, goes back to the turn of the century. It's a comic book version of the laugh track. It's a way of telling the reader this is the punchline. So even if the punchline isn't very funny, at least that tells you, yes, this is the punchline.
I think it goes...
And you'll always laugh at the guy falling backwards.
Yeah.
I think it goes back as far as Popeye.
Yeah, you don't think... Popeye, God, Seeger might have even invented it. For some reason, I keep thinking it goes back even farther than that, but I wouldn't be surprised if... A lot of these cartoony conventions Seeger seemed to have invented.
Well, it seems a pretty stable part of your work and Johnny Ryan's work.
Right.
Especially with his latest book.
I don't mean to do it, use it as often as I do. There's just, you know, it's like a hiccup. There's
it's one of those classic
things that
things.
I find myself doing all the time without thinking of it. And sometimes I think I should stop doing that. But then, I don't know, why stop?
Here's a quick question, and, you know, we may not get an answer. Will we ever see the Hulk comic?
They just... And again, for, I don't know if your readers, are, your listeners are aware of this, but I did a full-length, one-shot Spider-Man comic that I wrote through myself, and Marvel let me just...
Go crazy.
Within reason, just do my own take. So I did my own take of Spider-Man, just like I'm doing my own take of the Founding Fathers. And then and that was that came out, and then a couple years later, they had me do the same thing with the Hulk, only the Hulk... While I was in the middle of doing this one-shot Hulk comic, Marvel was purchased by this new corporation. And the corporation, they mainly manufactured toys and merchandising. You know, they don't have, nobody there had like a comic book background. And they spent way too much. It's like in the wake of that Spider-Man movie, they spent way too much to buy the rights to all the Marvel stuff. And all the board cared about was protecting the brand. And so they didn't... The fact that what I was doing was a satire, it didn't matter. They still thought it was, you know, messing with the brand. And so I finished it, and they paid me in full, but the board themselves decided not to release it. So it's been just collecting dust. But just recently, just a month ago or so, my editor called and just told me that, once again, it looks like it might be released.
Oh, good.
The thing is if they completely decide not to ever release it, then I could at least look into releasing it on my own. And of course, I'd have to change the name of the Hulk to something else, the Bulk. My editor is still he's determined to release it under the Marvel banner sooner or later. Well, the idea was I was going to do that with, like, we were talking tentatively about me giving a peat bag treatment to all the Marvel characters, like Iron Man, or basically whoever had a movie coming out, you know, because like the Spider-Man comic, that sold more than any comic I've ever drawn, but only because it was released the same month that the Spider-Man movie came out.
Hey, I had to buy one. It's the first Spider-Man comic I bought since I was 10.
I think he cried a little.
And then the same thing was going to happen with the Hulk, because the Hulk movie was coming out, so... That was the plan.
Well, I think it looks like there's never going to be another Hulk movie, or if it is, it's going to be not as high a caliber. Not that I can say that first one was a caliber of anything. Is there any future projects we have to look forward to? Or is it pretty much Apocalypse Nerd and Reason?
I really got to focus on getting this Apocalypse Nerd thing done. So there's that. And plus, I'm still doing stuff all the time for Reason. Every 4 months or so, or 3 months, I do a four-page feature for Reason magazine. And you can access the archives to all of it online. If you go to reason.com and search around, you'll find you'll see my name somewhere listed down on the left-hand
That's
side
also
of the
linked
page. So just click that and you'll see all of it there. But eventually that'll be collected into a book as soon as I have enough material for a book. And what else? There's always, you know, there's always like TV and animation projects that don't go anywhere that, you know, I might make a few pennies working on it in the meantime.
Will the Reason articles ever be collected?
Yeah, that's what I was saying. It will be. We need enough for a book.
Yeah.
But, there's not enough yet. It's still a couple years away.
And you also have stuff in Mad Magazine and sometimes Vice Magazine, too.
Not much in Vice. I did something just because Johnny Ryan was the editor of it.
Mm-hmm.
The pay wasn't that great, but I just did it just because I wanted to work with him. And with Mad, for a while I was in every issue, but they haven't given me a call in a while. Which, you know, again, you know, if they call me and ask me to do something, I'll do it. But it's no big deal because I got to get this Apocalypse
Nerd. Well,
and I don't know. I can't think of anything else too big. Some toys are coming out at the end of this month. You know what circus punks are?
Mm-hmm.
No.
For some reason, it's a weird fad. Those are those knockdown dolls from carnivals.
Oh, yeah.
And now that's become like the trendy thing is artists designing their own knockdown dolls, which they usually call circus punks. And now they're making mini ones, cheaper, smaller ones. So there's a company called Strange Co. They're a toy company. They're putting out all the hate characters.
And you also have the toys that you and Jim Woodring did, a set of toys.
Right, all the toys. They might still be available. I think you could still get them from Toy Robot. But yeah, Sony hired me and Jim Woodring and Charles Burns too, and a lot of other people to design our own sets of weird vending machine toys. Well, they were sold in vending machines in Japan, but over here you can get them in these individual little boxes, or you were able to. And my Japanese publisher also put out a Buddy Bradley doll last year. Oh, and then this September, my Japanese publisher is going to put out a CD booklet of the action suits. So, and we had to record new songs for it. So we recently got back together just to record enough songs to make a full length CD.
Will we ever see the action suits live?
Probably.
I have.
Because then we have to practice.
I saw you guys live.
Then way back in the day?
Way back. It was a small press festival in Seattle.
Okay, yeah, that's right, at Coca.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We reformed it. We sounded better than ever. Like, we just dusted off, like, these five old songs that we never recorded. And they came out great. We really sounded better than ever. But we practiced just for the sake of recording these five songs to fill out the CD. But the main problem is Eric Reynolds, the main action suit, he's in another band now. And it's always, like, really difficult for us to get even to just practice. Because, you know, what free time he has is taken up with his other bands. So, you know, so it's like, we were talking tentatively about at least playing for, like, a record release party when the record came out. But now I don't even think that's going
to
happen.
I'd make the trek down to Seattle.
Yeah, it's just such a pain in the ass, though.
It's like, I don't know, sometimes I forget how close Seattle is. I went down to go see Kraftwerk a couple of years ago, and it was like, I just forget, it's like 2 hours.
You know, it seems like a hop, skip, and a jump until you hit that goddamn border.
Yeah.
And I was so nervous.
then the rubber gloves come out.
Committing any crime. Just dealing with those people at the border. I hate it.
Well,
and it's worse coming this way. I admit it's worse coming into the States.
I don't know. We are Canadian guys. If you're bringing up any material of questionable content.
Bombs.
No, comics.
Or comics.
Comics is the big one. Yeah.
It's bombs, then comics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, they're pretty equal. So we're at the end of our hour. The other guys are here staring at me to wrap up. I have the other music I brought. I got Pet Sounds here. I also have the rest of the tracks from your website of the action suits.
Play that. What the heck? Everybody's already heard Pet Sounds.
Yeah. What would you like to hear? We already played Fun Flies.
What's a good one?
Yeah. Four track. I like Four Track Mind a lot.
Play My Janine. That's the dirty one.
Oh, the one about the 14-year-old.
My daughter heard that for the first time and freaked out. She's like,
Dad!
I'm 15. What does that make me, chop liver? Over the hill? Dad.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I'll send you an email to let you know when we have our podcast posted up.
Nice talking to you.
And I hope to meet you one day down in Seattle.
Yeah, no, I'm sure we'll meet sooner or later. And nice talk to you again, Colin. It's been a million years.
Oh, I'll come back down sometime.
All right, well, take care, you guys.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. Sure, bye-bye.
That was Peter Bagg, creator of Hate, Neat Stuff, Apocalypse Nerd, Bat Boy, and a whole slew of other stuff. Check out Pete's Bag stuff, Peter. Peter Bagg has a website, www.peterbagg.com. Almost all of his stuff, except for Apocalypse Nerd, is available from our friends at Fantagraphics. Those good folks keep putting out good stuff. A couple of quick comic news biddies. For folks in Vancouver, in the latest issue of The West Ender, Julian Lawrence and Drippy from Drippy Town Comics and Stories is on the cover. And on Saturday night is the Comics Jam. So if you like drawing comics with other comic geeks, go to the Jolly Alderman on Saturday night. I think Colin will be there.
Starts about 8 o'clock.
8 o'clock, Jolly Alderman. So and we're running late, and the boys are giving me dirty looks. So here's My Janine by the wonderful boys called The Action Suits in Seattle. New album will be out from Press Pop Publications in September.